Are we on?
Yeah.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to DBSA Boston. My name is Mary Johnston, and I will introduce our speaker tonight. Dr. Annie Fox is an assistant professor of quantitative methods at the Mass General Institute of Health Professionals. She got a PhD from the University of Connecticut, and I'll let her introduce herself further than that.
Sure.
Please welcome her.
Is this on? Hi, thank you for having me. As Mary said, I'm an assistant professor at MGH Institute of Health Professions. I've been at the Institute for 2 years. Prior to that, I worked at the National Center for PTSD for 5 years. And so some of the work that I did at the VA and have continued at the IHP, I'm going to talk to you about today. I'm trained as a social psychologist, and my primary research interest is in stigma. And so when I worked at the VA, it was a great opportunity to study mental illness stigma in a population of people with high need for treatment and high experience of mental illness. So the title of my talk today is How and When Does Mental Illness Stigma Impact Treatment Seeking? Can everybody hear me?
You gotta hold it real close.
Okay, it's like kind of awkward, but. Okay, so just to give some context and a little bit of background here, so if we look at rates of mental illness in the United States, the most recent statistics from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration find that about 45 million people, or 20% of adults in the U.S., experienced a mental illness in the past year. And of those 45 million people, only 43% of people experiencing a mental health problem seek treatment. And then even more problematic is we see that about 20% of individuals who do seek treatment drop out. So there's a clear public health problem here in that we have people in need who are not seeking treatment. And to give you a little background on similar statistics in a veteran population, which is what I've focused, what a lot of my research has been focused on, we see that treatment-seeking rates among military members and veterans do not parallel the high needs for care. So within a veteran population, the statistics are that about 14 to 29% of veterans are experience post-traumatic stress disorder, and about 20% experience depression, and 20% experience substance abuse or alcohol abuse. So we know that there's pretty high prevalence within the veteran population as well as the general population. But within the veteran population, we see that they're not seeking care. So even though the VA offers a number of evidence-based treatments for PTSD and depression, often at no cost, veterans don't seek them out. And less than half of all veterans who screen positive for PTSD in primary care actually follow up with the mental health services if they've been recommended. So we know that both in the veteran population and in the general population that we have there are clearly some barriers to care here. So there is a lot of research looking at why people don't seek mental health treatment when they need it. And we can break those down into four categories. So the first is logistic barriers. So transportation, childcare are often identified as logistic barriers to being able to seek care. A lot of people also report insurance or cost issues as a barrier to care. And then another common barrier is perceived need, in that there are people who are experiencing or who report experience symptoms but don't feel that they actually need treatment. And you can't get somebody into treatment who doesn't feel like they need it. And then finally, the barrier that is probably one of the most often reported is stigma. Now, when I say stigma, probably everybody in the room knows what that means, right? But what's interesting about stigma and mental illness stigma in particular is that if I went around the room and asked everybody to define it, we'd probably get a different definition from every single person. Because everybody kind of knows what it means, but everybody has a slightly different conception of what that means. And that's actually true in the research literature as well. So that researchers who are studying mental illness stigma are defining it a million different ways. And so it becomes very hard to understand how mental illness stigma might be impacting people's decision to seek treatment when they're not defining the concept in the same way. So this question of what is mental illness stigma is a really important one. And so what my colleagues and I did is we really took a step back and started thinking about, well, what is mental illness stigma? And we looked in the literature and we looked at both qualitative and quantitative things, so interviews and focus groups, what people have asked and how people have experienced stigma, and also the survey research. There's tons of survey research both in the United States and abroad. And we came up with kind of a framework that represents all the different ways that people experience mental illness stigma. And so the first thing when you're thinking about stigma is that we can come at it from two perspectives. The first is thinking about stigma from the perspective of the person doing the stigmatizing, right? So in that case, that's people who are who hold beliefs, negative beliefs about people who are experiencing a mental health problem. And we can then separate that into people's personal beliefs, right? What beliefs do you hold about people with mental illness? And then we can separate it further into perceived stigma. So what do you think other people think about people with mental illness? And that's an important distinction, what you think versus what you think other people think. And then we can break that down a little further. So the types of beliefs that people have are called stereotypes, right? And people hold different beliefs about what somebody who has mental illness is, what their characteristics are, what their personality traits are, why they have mental illness, and those fall under the realm of stereotypes. Prejudice represents the emotional piece of it. So are people like fear or anger directed towards people who have a mental illness? And then there's discrimination, so actually people acting negatively towards somebody who has a mental illness. And then we can break this down even further and think about stigma related to mental illness itself, or specific mental illnesses, or stigma related to treatment seeking. And that's an important distinction as well, because the stereotypes of somebody who seeks treatment versus somebody who has a mental illness are actually slightly different. And so it's possible that these two different ways of thinking about stigma impact people's decision to seek treatment differently. And then all of these different pieces of stigma on this side of my chart here are related to outcomes, right? And when you're thinking about the perspective of somebody who is doing the stigmatizing, that often relates to discrimination or in things like public policy support. So that your attitudes and your behaviors inform what you think about public policies that are related to mental illness or mental illness treatment. So that's one side of the coin. The other way we can come at thinking about stigma is from the perspective of the person who has the mental illness, or who has, this model also applies to other stigmatized conditions, if you think about things like weight-based stigma or stigma related to being an LGBTQ, or so there's different types of stigma that this would also apply to. But we can think about it from the perspective of the person doing the stigmatizing. I'm sorry, the perspective of the person who's being stigmatized. Right, and we can break that down into three different types of stigma. So there's internalized stigma, which is when you apply the stereotypes of mental illness to the self. So an example being a common stereotype of mental illness is that you're weak. So then you would say, if you've internalized stigma, that you are weak because you have a mental illness. Another one is anticipated stigma, which is the extent to which people are concerned about what other people think of them, right? How much are you worried about being discriminated against? How much are you worried about people finding out, right? What you're worried about the consequences of people knowing and treating you differently because you have a mental illness. And then there's experience stigma, which is actually being the target of discrimination, right? Experiencing that aspect of stigma. Once again, we can break these down into internalized, anticipated, and experienced stigma related to mental illness, or those mechanisms related to treatment seeking. And then there are a number of negative outcomes that are associated with endorsing any of these different types of stigma. For example, treatment avoidance, treatment delay, lack of treatment adherence, decreased mental health, decreased physical health, social withdrawal, and increased health risk behaviors. And that's not a comprehensive list, but those are some of the big ones that have been found in the literature that are associated with these types of stigma. So this was the framework that we developed, and we were able to go through all the literature that had been published on mental illness stigma in the past 10 years and look and classify articles and measures based on these different types of stigma mechanisms. And the benefit of that and why it was really important, because it allowed us to see, well, what constructs are people, are researchers really focusing on, right? Where has all the attention been focused, and where is there room to like explore further? And what we found is that this side here, the perspective of the stigmatizer, there's tons of research on. The other side, there's a lot less. And in particular, anticipated stigma and experienced stigma are the ones that are studied the least. And so that provided a great opportunity to jump in and look at some research that examines those stigma mechanisms. I'm sorry, internalized stigma and anticipated stigma. And then we were also started thinking about how all of these different ways of experiencing stigma might work in a process to impact people's decision to seek treatment. And so what we're hypothesizing is that your personal beliefs and your perceived beliefs and your experiences of stigma impact the extent to which you anticipate stigma. And that, in turn, impacts the extent to which you internalize stigma. And then that impacts treatment use or treatment intentions or even attitudes towards treatment. So this is the model that we're proposing. And this would be very big and very difficult to test. And nobody has conducted a study that has measured all these different facets of stigma. And so very recently, I got a little bit of money to do a study where we are able to measure all of these mechanisms. And I am just about finished collecting data. But while I was at the VA, I was taking part in a study looking at the work and family function of veterans over time. And we were able to throw in some questions about stigma as well as mental health and mental health treatment that allowed us to look at this piece of this model. So to give you a little background, just to talk a little bit about what research has been done in this area, we know that there's a large body of research examining the relationship between mental illness stigma and treatment seeking. But the problem is there's very little consensus about how stigma impacts treatment seeking. And you know, when we did that big whole-scale study of looking at all the ways people have measured it and studied it, what we find is that it really depends on which stigma mechanism you're looking at. And the two that we think are likely playing an important role are anticipated stigma and internalized stigma. So anticipated stigma, just to reiterate what I said earlier, is commonly reported in both civilian and veteran samples. And so individuals with mental illness or substance abuse endorse anticipated stigma more than any other type of concealable stigmatized identities. And so a concealable stigmatized identity is a stigmatized identity that you're able to kind of, people can't see it on the outside, right? People don't necessarily look at you and know that you have a socially devalued identity, like that you have mental illness or a chronic health condition or whatever it might be. But the research looking at anticipated stigma and treatment seeking is very mixed. So some studies show that the more you anticipate stigma, the less likely you are to seek treatment, or the less likely you are to endorse treatment-seeking intentions, or they're negatively associated with treatment engagement. But there are other studies that show there's absolutely no relationship, and there's even some studies showing a positive relationship, where anticipating stigma might actually drive people into treatment. Now, with internalized stigma, we also see that this is pretty commonly endorsed. And there are some pretty large international studies that find anywhere between 25 to 50% of samples endorsing internalized stigma. And an internalized stigma is particularly problematic because it negatively impacts self-efficacy, self-esteem, hope, empowerment, social support, and quality of life. And because internalized stigma has such a strong impact on these elements, we think that it's probably more closely related or more proximately related to treatment seeking than anticipated stigma, because it's affecting the self, right? If you don't think you have the power to seek treatment, right, that means it's probably closer to whether or not you're going to seek treatment than things that are a little bit farther away. So we looked for studies that have examined these two stigma mechanisms, anticipated stigma and internalized stigma, and there's only one in the literature. And this was a study done in Connecticut in a community sample of people with mental illness, and they did find this relationship between anticipated stigma. And it was that the more anticipated stigma you endorsed, the more internalized stigma you endorsed. So we knew there was probably something here, but we wanted to look at it longitudinally. So does the extent to which you anticipate stigma now impact whether you're going to seek treatment later on, and does that have a relationship with internalized stigma? And so we know there's no other studies that have examined this. And so our big research question here was, does internalized stigma serve as the link in the relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking? So this was a three-wave longitudinal study of post 9/11 veterans. The first survey was administered, I believe, in 2011, and it was more than 1,000 people. And then 4.5 years later, we surveyed them again, and we had a return of a sample size of about 524 people. And then 18 months after that, we surveyed them one more time. So and our final sample size was 455 veterans. We used a mail survey procedure where we mailed people a survey with a $25 Visa gift card, and then we followed up every 2 weeks with a postcard and then another copy of the survey, and we did that for 6 weeks. So they end up getting 6 different mailings. And we see that that actually works pretty well in getting people to respond. Our response rates for veterans here, these are actually pretty good for a veteran mail survey. So we limited, to look at this research question, we limited the study to individuals who had probable depression and who completed the time 2 and the time 3 surveys. We had pretty even split between men and women. The majority of the sample was white. The mean age was 38, and we see that the majority were married or partnered, and about 60% had a college degree or higher. We measured depression with a self-report measure, so this is the Beck Depression Inventory. And then we measured stigma and mental illness stigma with 2 items. So the first one was to measure anticipated stigma. If I had a mental health problem and my friends and family knew about it, they would think less of me. And then internalized stigma, seeking mental health treatment would make me think less of myself. Now, ideally, we would be able to measure these things with a lot more items, but we're lucky to get these into the survey. So we were trying to just make sure we picked items that really captured the essence of these two constructs. And then finally, we asked people about their treatment seeking since the previous survey. So it was about in the past 18 months, essentially. Any inpatient, outpatient, or medication for any mental health problems since July 2015. Okay, so our question, does internalized stigma serve as the link between the relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking? And so the first step there was to look and see, are these things actually related? And that's what we found. So we see here that anticipated stigma, the more people anticipated stigma, the more they internalized it, which is what we expected. And then the next piece would be to look at whether internalized stigma is then related to treatment seeking. And again, we find this, they're a negative relationship, so that the more people were internalizing stigma, the less likely they were to have sought treatment in the past 18 months. And then the last piece when you're doing a model like this is to look at that direct relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking. And if that path is not significant, that means that the relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking is actually going through internalized stigma. And that's exactly what we found. So that means that there's no, in this model, in this case, there's no direct relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking. Instead, the more you anticipate stigma, the more you internalize it, and it's the more you internalize it that leads to less treatment seeking. So we were really excited about that because that was the first longitudinal study that has looked at both of those constructs and how they impact treatment seeking. But we also started thinking that there's probably more to the puzzle there, and that there is something missing. And in particular, nobody had examined the role of symptom severity. So there's all this talk about mental illness stigma, but nobody actually looks to see how symptoms impact this. And they're quite related. So we had that information, and so we decided to take a look at that. And we know that people with more severe symptoms are more likely to endorse anticipated stigma. And so it very well could be the case that people with lower levels of symptom might actually be motivated by anticipated stigma, but people at higher levels, it might serve as a barrier. And so we wanted to explore that hypothesis by including symptoms into our model. And so that's what we did. So we took depressive symptoms and we looked at the relationship between depressive symptoms and those different paths in our model. And what we found was that, that's a little hard to read on the screen, but as symptom severity increased, the relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking actually switches direction. It goes from positive to negative. So what that means is that for if you're experiencing low levels of depression symptoms, but again, meeting criteria for depression, so just mild depression, there's actually a positive relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking. The more you anticipate being discriminated against, the more likely you are to seek treatment. But as symptom severity increases, that direction changes, so that people who are experiencing higher levels of depression are anticipated stigma, the more you anticipate stigma, the less likely you are to seek treatment. And then the other piece was to see if internalized stigma was playing the same role at different levels of symptomatology. And again, we see that the relationship changes depending on how severe your symptoms are. So here, what we found is that at mild to moderate levels of depression, that model held, that anticipated stigma led to internalized stigma led to treatment seeking. But at really high levels of depression, there's this direct relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment seeking, and internalized stigma no longer matters. And so that was really interesting to us because nobody had looked at this before. So just to, I know those models are a little complicated, so just to kind of summarize what we found, as depressive symptoms increase, the relationship between anticipated stigma and mental health treatment becomes more negative. So at lower levels of depression, anticipated stigma is associated with increased mental health treatment use, but at higher levels of depression, it's negatively associated, so you're less likely to have sought treatment. We also found at mild to average levels of depressive symptoms, internalized stigma linked the relationship between anticipated stigma and use of mental health treatment. But at the highest level of depressive symptoms, about 90th percentile, actually I think it's 75th to 90th percentile, internalized stigma no longer linked that relationship. Instead, there was this pretty strong direct negative relationship between anticipated stigma and treatment use. The more you anticipated stigma, the less likely you were to have sought treatment. So there's a few take-home messages from this work. One is that I think it's really important to consider symptom severity when we're thinking about the relationship between stigma and treatment seeking. These different stigma mechanisms work differently. And in this case, anticipated stigma may actually motivate or hinder treatment seeking depending on how severe your symptoms are. And the other big piece of this is that it's really important not to look at stigma mechanisms in isolation. It's likely that they work in a process, or they impact one another, or they operate independently or uniquely. But you need to pay attention to that when we're thinking about stigma in a research context. And we've identified this need for research examining the relationships among other stigma mechanisms. And so this model here is what we're hoping to tackle to see if we can figure out what this process is. And we've already kind of filled in some of this, but now the next step is to look at these outside factors and how they influence this whole process. And then another really important piece here is that there are other factors that can influence your experience of stigma, treatment seeking. And we've looked at those, or we're going to look at those. We have the data now. We're going to look at gender, race and ethnicity, social support, stigma resistance, and again, of course, symptom severity. So finally, I think the last implication for this research is that it has implications for anti-stigma interventions. So often, stigma interventions are kind of one-size-fits-all campaigns, and they're directed at like the general population, right? Trying to encourage people or change attitudes about mental illness or mental health treatment seeking. But what this data shows is that one-size-fits-all strategy might not be as effective as more targeted or tailored campaigns. So if we know that people who are varying in symptom severity, different stigma mechanisms are impacting them, the messaging might be different, right? For some people, it might be important to target anticipated stigma, right? People who have really severe symptoms. For others, it might be targeting internalized stigma. And so this data and these findings have the ability to impact how we target people to try to motivate them to get into treatment. So I just want to acknowledge my colleagues at the VA, Dawn Vogt and Brian Smith, who had the funding to do this research, and then the MGH Institute of Health Professions, my current institution, who's given me the funds to collect more data on this. And I am happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. I have two questions.
Sure.
If I may.
Of course.
The first one is if your research sheds any light on if talking about evidence of stigma, if that makes the internalized stigma worse. I think especially in a context like this, at times, and I've seen with different therapists as well, some are comfortable talking about how the stigma can be real and how to have future opportunities, you might be very guarded in expressing it in some circumstances. Others are worried that talking about that might cause someone to increase their internal stigma or avoid treatment.
Right.
That's the first question.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I don't have data on that, but I'm coming at it from a social psychologist perspective, not a clinical psychologist perspective. But when I've talked with my clinical psychology friends about whether or not they address stigma in treatment, most of them don't. And I think what your point is a really good one, is that people have different concerns about what that might do, right? It might make things worse, it might make things better. Across the board, there's no research that I know of on that, but I think that's probably really important to explore is, even within a treatment context, how does talking about stigma impact the treatment process itself? Yeah.
A second question is, if you look at stigma within the mental health profession among providers, because one thing that I've definitely seen is that often for people who are more symptomatic, they can often find it harder to get care, which I haven't seen in any other area of medicine. Often triage works if you're really desperate for care, you get it sooner. Whereas among therapists, in particular, and outpatient psychiatrists, I found many who will ask certain questions, and if they hear that you or a loved one is suicidal, a lot of them will say, I cannot treat you. Mm-hmm. And it often becomes harder to get care. And then there's other things as well. You know, many providers aren't comfortable treating someone with a dual diagnosis of substance issues, mm-hmm. with anger issues, especially if they're male,
yep.
With certain diagnoses that some people call, frankly, the kiss of death. Mm-hmm. You know, like, yeah, you can yeah. guess what some of those are.
Yeah. No, you bring up some really great points, I think, about... you know, just because you're a mental health professional doesn't mean that you don't hold stigmatizing attitudes, right? And that's another essential barrier to care. And people, not just mental health providers, but primary care and physical health care. And so one of the things I know that they're doing at the VA to combat some of that is they've tried to integrate mental health care into primary care. But again, people aren't, they don't seek treatment, but why they're not seeking treatment, I think we still don't have a great sense of why that is.
Do you have a sense of if they might be seeking treatment but unable to get treatment?
It's a great question. I don't know. I know in the VA they have to offer everybody treatment. So, but I don't know in another setting how that would be. But yeah, those are really great questions. Thank you.
Two simple questions. When somebody sort of bullies or has a stigma against you, mm-hmm. outside stigma,
yeah.
doesn't that drive your internalized of what you feel about yourself?
Yes, absolutely.
And the other thing is I found that some of it, I'm just wondering whether you ever look at the cultural aspect of it, because some yeah. cultures, and I won't mention any, feel that you shouldn't go to a psychiatrist.
Yep. No, yes, absolutely. And that is something that we're trying to address. The problem is recruitment and samples. Like, so for example, in this, we have 400 people, but we don't have a large enough sample of racial or ethnic minorities to begin to look or pinpoint cultural differences in this. But I have spoken with a researcher at MGH who does all of her research is looking at culture and discrimination in the healthcare setting. And so there might be a future collaboration there where we might be able to look at how this process works within different cultures. Absolutely, yeah.
So I have a question. Mentioned depressive, was your study just about depression or did it cover other diagnoses?
We had, we measured PTSD, depression, and anxiety. For the purposes of this data analysis and to make things a little simpler, we focused on just depression. And that's because there's an argument to be made that stigma varies by diagnosis, and that like a diagnosis like PTSD, people might experience mental illness stigma, but it might be a little different in that there's like an external cause, right? There's some sort of traumatic event that has happened to somebody versus stereotypes of depression where people think you can kind of snap out of it. And so there's that causal connection. And so the stigma tends to be stronger among people experiencing depression or anxiety than it does with PTSD. So that's why we kept it just looking at depression. But absolutely we had other. Yeah.
I'm just curious, I'm not sure if you can answer it, but you said that for people with severe symptoms, they tend to get less treatment. And I guess my question is, do you have any sense of yet whether they've given up because mm-hmm. treatment hasn't worked?
Yeah, this is actually a conversation I had with one of my colleagues in thinking about whether that's actually like a symptom, right? That you can't, you're not functioning when you have that high a level, and so you're not able to get treatment. This is survey data, so we can't really dive into that, but I certainly think it's a possibility, yeah. Somebody way in the back.
I'll get to you.
Now that we know of the various aspects of stigma, mm-hmm. what would you recommend, and to whom would you recommend to educate all of us?
Mm-hmm.
about this so that that could be diminished? Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. One, I think, is people talking about it, right? That we can't have a fear of being able to identify yourself as somebody who has experiencing mental health, mental illness, or seeking mental health treatment. But there are also resources online. So the National Alliance for Mental Illness has a whole website dedicated to stigma and trying to fight stigma. There are, like I mentioned, a number of interventions. They tend to be targeted towards the general population. But those type of interventions provide knowledge and statistics to help normalize mental illness to the extent that we know that it's pretty common. I saw a recent statistic that about 50% of people will experience a mental health problem in their lifetime. So, right, that's a statistic that, you know somebody, if it's not yourself, in your lifetime who is experiencing or has experienced a mental health problem. So, having the conversation, looking for resources, I think is an important step in that process.
One of the things that's really important to me is that there are an awful lot of people who have conditions that are not related to mental health, mm-hmm. but have mental health effects as a result of those. For example, I'm unable to recognize faces. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there are a collection of things that go along with that. But I can't tell you the number of people that I've communicated with who simply didn't know that they couldn't recognize faces because they had nothing to compare it to.
Yeah.
And as a result, they've gone through the entire process. They've gotten a wide variety of misdiagnoses to the point where it just hasn't been useful to them until they happen to stumble along onto something that talks about this, mm-hmm. and they're able to get a more accurate answer to their issues. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question that I have is there some research at this point that is delineating between issues that are strictly mental health related and those whereby people are internalizing it as a mental health issue, even though it might be something external?
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I don't know of any research that's being done in that area. I don't think so. But that's certainly something that's worth exploring. I know that there are studies looking at physical health conditions that might have implications for mental illness. But, I'm thinking like chronic illness or chronic pain, but none in the way that you describe. So, yeah, that's certainly something that needs to be explored further.
Hi, thank you so much for your presentation and your interest in this field and in this area. It's, beneficial in many ways to many of us. Just a quick question is, could you give us an example of an anti-stigma intervention that might be more customized, mm-hmm. what that might look like, or what were some of the ideas of what that might look like?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. There's a lot of education-based initiatives, and you think about like public health campaigns where you see like posters and messaging. But it's usually like one message. And so when we're thinking about more targeted campaigns, we're thinking about varying those messages, right? Looking at the group of people that you're trying to target and maybe having a different message, right? Maybe it's not knowledge. Maybe it's something like it's okay to seek treatment, right? That trying to destigmatize that piece of it. Or 50% of people experience mental illness in your lifetime, right? Like, and trying to normalize and figure out which pieces of the messaging might impact people differently. And I think that's going to take some research to figure out what messages are going to be most appropriate and what messages target these different aspects of stigma. Because even when these stigma interventions measure stigma, it's often just attitudes. So it's really just your personal beliefs. There's not, as far as I know, research looking at how these things target these other mechanisms that we've identified. So there's a lot to be done, I think, in still developing what those interventions might look like. Yeah.
Any other questions?
There's one up here.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm one of those people that my family thinks I'm bipolar, and to be honest, I am at the lowest point in my life right now. I am severely depressed, and I can't get out of it. Mm-hmm. No matter what medication I take, mm-hmm. it has adverse effects.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to shock anybody, but I mean, I would rather die than live like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But you're here, so that says something, right?
Yeah, but my family forced me to come.
And you have a social support network, right? That is taking care of you, that's concerned about you. Yeah. So I think those are all positive steps that I think are important that can help you get better.
Yeah.
And being willing, which you obviously are because you're here, being willing to take advantage and lean on those supports, I think is really important.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the presentation. I have a question about the education. Have you looked at the biomedical model versus the biopsychosocial model? The biomedical model creates mm-hmm. more stigma, and all the lot of the campaigns say that it's just something in your brain, it's a chemical imbalance, when it's not 100% true. Thank you.
Yeah, no, my research, I have not looked at that, but I am familiar with what you're talking about. I know that I saw some research. I think the original thought was that if we can present mental illness as like a biological disorder or a medical disorder, that would decrease the stigma. But the research, I think, does not actually support that. And I feel like I read something recently where it might actually have the opposite effect, where it's actually leading to increased stigma. But that's not—it's not my area. But I do know that is an important distinction in thinking about. But that goes back to thinking about how do we design these interventions in a way like where we kind of take the pieces of the message and figure out what's working before we roll it out on a wide scale, in a wide scale effort.
Okay, time for one more question. Anyone have one more?
My question is, like, for people that are not going to seek attention when they're more symptomatic, could some of the explanation for that be that in the past, when they have voice to their healthcare providers that they're having more symptoms, the outcome is you get your meds raised, they get changed, and you end up in a hoarding room in a hospital.
Yeah.
So that it's not really about some form of stigma so much as about these are just outcomes that I don't want to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll cancel my appointment.
Yeah.
See if it gets better. So.
Yeah, in thinking about it from a stigma perspective, I think how people's engagement with people's engagement with the healthcare system, I think, impacts their future, like how much they want to in the future, right? So this is actually something I'm interested in exploring further because, as far as I know, there's not a lot of data on that. That if you've had a bad experience with your primary healthcare provider for whatever reason, does that make you less likely to seek mental health treatment later on, even for something totally unrelated? That your negative attitudes about the healthcare system impact whether or not you seek treatment. But I think that's kind of related to what you're saying, right? If you have an experience that is just very aversive, does that make you less likely to want to come back or to cancel your appointment? So yeah, I think that's an important thing to consider.
Okay, let's thank Dr. Buck. Thank you very much.